Good morning. This meeting will come to order. This is a public meeting of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. I'd like to welcome members of the public, market participants, and members of the media, as well as those listening to this meeting through phone and webcast. I'd like to thank Commissioners Chilton, O'Malley, and Wiegand for their contributions to this rule writing process and the CFTC's hardworking and dedicated staff. This final set of customer protection reforms comprehensively enhances the protections around the handling and segregation of futures and swaps customer funds. This is a public meeting, I should say, that's partially Dodd-Frank related because it relates to swaps funds. But if you noted, I didn't say this was a Dodd-Frank meeting. This is really just solely about customer funds and customer protection. And that's because segregation of customer funds is the core foundation of the commodity futures and swaps markets. Segregation must be maintained at all times. That means every moment of every day. Market events, though, of these last 2 years highlighted that the Commission must do everything within our authorities and resources to strengthen oversight programs and protection of customer funds. And today's reforms are the sixth set of rules finalized by this Commission, if we move forward to finalize them, during a 2-year process to ensure that customers have the confidence that their funds are segregated and protected. These reforms benefit from a Commission's thorough review of existing customer protection rules, really looking for any gaps in those rules, and the oversight of these markets. They benefit from significant public input, including staff roundtables, the Technology Advisory Committee, I thank you, Commissioner O'Malley, the Agriculture Advisory Committee meetings, and numerous reports submitted by market participants. They also benefit from input throughout a coordinated effort of the CFTC with other regulators, the self-regulatory organizations such as the CME and the National Futures Association, and also congressional reports and input on these matters. I will be supporting today's rules, and in summary, at least for 6 reasons. They're quite comprehensive, but the 6 that I want to highlight. 1, FCMs, clearing members, have to significantly enhance their supervision of and accounting for customer funds. They will have to put in place additional policies and procedures for these new protections. 2, there's a significant set of enhancements around outside accounting and auditing. First, at the actual accountant or CPAs that look at futures commission merchants, but also with regard to the self-regulatory organizations and how they audit the FCMs. 3, there's significant customer fund changes or significant changes with regard to how funds have been moved around. It basically, when a firm moves money within a firm, how can they move that money around? Some of these were adopted by self-regulatory organizations, the withdrawal of 25% or more, and the pre-approval of those movements of monies. But there are significant protections with regard to the movement of monies, and related to this, acknowledgement letters from the banks as well, acknowledging how those monies are done. 4th, relates to investing in international futures accounts. Our Part 30 regime really had not kept pace or kept up with the protections in domestic futures accounts. And with these reforms today and the reforms that the NFA had put in place earlier, investing in foreign futures accounts will be significantly aligned with the protections. They won't be identical, but they'll be significantly aligned with the protections for domestic futures accounts. Fifth, there's significant new transparency. Transparency to the regulators that we will be able to see electronically, along with the self-regulatory organizations, to see custodial accounts and cash accounts on a daily basis. And transparency to the public as well, with the twice a month statements of what's in the investment accounts itself. These reforms also have been put in place by the self-regulatory organizations, but it's important that we do this at the federal level as well and put it in our rules. And then sixth, the final rules include provisions on capital and residual interest of the FCMs themselves. Quite possibly the most debated features of these reforms, but I think they're important reforms as well. And in response to comments on this provision, we are phasing in compliance to smooth implementation. And as the staff will present, calling for significant new studies and roundtables on these matters and providing for a 5-year phase-in on these matters. But I think it is important that we look very closely at the law that's been in place for some time, and align and ensure that one customer's funds or property are not used in some way to secure or guarantee other people's accounts. Now, prior to this final rule set, the Commission's already made important improvements to protection of customers. And in a longer statement for the record, I go through that. But it's really a remarkable achievement, and I want to thank my fellow commissioners. Commissioner, I see former Commissioner Mike Dunn here, Commissioner Jill Summers as well, because this has been a 2-year journey, and this is the sixth set of rules that we're considering, and I think we're well needed to do that. Before I turn it to my fellow commissioners, am I supposed to do this other intro thing or do it after them? I do it after. All right, so then I turn it to you, Commissioner Chilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, you know, one of the sort of strange things you do, particularly like you're coming from a staffer on the Hill and then you get confirmed, is you actually stand up there and you do this oath thing, and it's a little strange because you haven't done it before. You've seen lots of witnesses do it. But so we all took this oath to uphold the Constitution, but also to uphold the Commodity Exchange Act. And a lot of times over the years, I found myself, and my commissioner colleagues probably have too, where it's like, well, I don't really like the law so much, but it's the law. And so you got to deal with it. Sometimes the law leaves lots of latitude for attitude. Sometimes we can mess around with it a little bit. Other times, not so much. And on this one, not so much. It's really pretty clear that we are supposed to protect customer funds all the time. In fairness, we haven't done it as well, if you look at the history, as I think we should have. This rule gets to where we need to be. It comports with the law. It protects customers. Now, there's been some discussion lately about how this may impact, particularly the Section 4D stuff, with regard to whether or not it would negatively impact end users, particularly farmers and ranchers, folks who many of us, but certainly me, hold near and dear to my heart and agree with them on most policy. And I agree with them on this one. But I disagree with the outcome of what the rule does, because this is precisely to protect farmers, ranchers, and end users from an MF Global or Peregrine type situation. No longer will people be able to use at FCMs, the money as sort of a slush fund to co-mingle it and just say, well, you owe margin, but somebody else doesn't owe margin, so we'll just let it float. Everything's going to be copacetic. The law says we can't do that. So that's what I'm looking at. This will protect farmers. It will protect ranchers. It will protect end users in the energy and the metals sector. So I think it's a good rule. I appreciate the time that everybody's spent on it. I appreciate what my colleagues have done. And the last thing, by the way, is, and I'm not trying to foretell what we might do, But we always deal with exemptive relief given unforeseen circumstances. If something is technologically impractical, if there is some reason that we have not anticipated, and we've not anticipated a lot of them in the past, but if there's some reason that something's not anticipated, sure, we'll consider whether or not there's appropriate relief. But at this point, there is a year implementation period, and then there's 5 years. Heck, none of us may be here in 5 years. A lot of members of Congress, some would even hope, are gone in 5 years. Congress can change the law if they want, but our job is to uphold the law, and that's what this rule does. Thank you.
Commissioner Chilton, I thank you, and Commissioner Amaya.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the staff for their hard work on this customer protection rule. This has been almost a year and a half in the making, 2 years in the making. So obviously a number of staff, DSIO, DCR, OGC have all contributed to this rulemaking. And in the wake of the global financial crisis, it is important to intensify regulatory efforts to strengthen customer protection policies in order to promote financial stability of the derivatives market. There's no dispute, customer protection must be the cornerstone of the Commission's oversight. Sound customer protection policies and measures to improve the efficiency and transparency of financial markets are critically important. I do not disagree at all with that. I do support several provisions of the rule that allow customers greater insight into the operations of an FCM. Provisions include improved FCM disclosure regime that will give customers new and critical information about their FCM exposures, eliminate the alternative method for calculating segregation under 30.7 funds. These are the foreign futures that the chairman spoke about. Improved reporting of segregated fund balances and enhancement to risk management procedures. I also support all those. However, my main concern with the draft rule is in the radical interpretation of the long-standing residual interest deadline. This is a reinterpretation. This reinterpretation decreases the time for which customers' margin calls must arrive at their FCMs from the current 3 days to just 1 day. Such a change would mean a significant increase in the pre-funding of margin, perhaps nearly double based on some of the reports we've received. As a result, many small agribusiness hedgers will have to consider alternative risk management tools, or even worse, they could be forced out of the market. Now, I recognize the Commodity Exchange Act does not permit an FCM to use the money of one customer to margin the futures and options of another customer. However, I believe that the Commission, in deciding whether to reinterpret this provision, must make a decision based on the facts and data. Therefore, I'm proposing an amendment that would continue to make progress in accelerating the collection of margin of customer funds from 3 days to after the settlement date to just 1 day, ending at 6 p.m. Eastern. Just like the final rule, the amendment would be phased in over 1 year. It would following the date of publication of the rules in the Federal Register. And just like the draft final rule, the amendment would also require a study to determine the feasibility of changing the collection date and the costs associated with such a move. The main difference between my amendment and the draft rule is my amendment does not mandate that in 5 years' time, customers will need to meet the margin obligations by the end of the settlement cycle. The amendment simply lets a future commission make a determination about the best way to proceed after it has collected all the evidence. In other words, the amendment does not bias a study with an outcome that has been previously determined. Instead, my amendment would ask a future commission to perform the analysis and decide at that point, analyzing it against future technology and payment methodologies, what the best course of action should be. This way, the future commission can make an informed and unbiased decision. If the commission votes for my amendment, I'd be happy to support this rule. Again, I want to express my thanks for the commission staff for their efforts on this rule. And let me close by thanking so many of the division staff from the Division of Enforcement, who have devoted their long hours to bring recent charges against Rabobank and all the other LIBOR settlements. Their work must be recognized by the Commission and by the work as the work of the staff from OGC and DMO as well. But I'd like to particularly address the folks from Division of Enforcement for their work to bring these cases to secure the settlements and change the behavior. So with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, let me just recognize the names here. Ann Termine, Stephen Tsai, Maura Wehmeyer, Philip Tumminio, Tim Kirby, Jonathan Huth, Brian Mulheron, Rishi Gupta, Amy Latimer Zayats, Jason Wright, Elizabeth Padgett, and Terry Mile. These are the folks that have been very engaged, working to support this commission and to bring these big settlements, which are very important and will have a big change in the market. So I want to just recognize them for their hard work in the trenches. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have.
Thank you, Commissioner Amelia. Commissioner Wiegand.
Thank you, Chairman Gensler. And my thanks to the professional staff for their hard work on the important final rule we are considering today regarding customer protection. The CFTC's core mission is to protect futures and swap customers from fraud, manipulation, abusive practices, and systemic risk. In pursuing this mission, it is vital that the Commission unceasingly look to update and improve the protections we have in order to better protect the public and ensure the safety, soundness, and integrity of those operating in the derivatives marketplace. The final customer protection rule before us today requires important improvements to a range of protections that have been implemented by the Commission and industry in recent months. It fills certain remaining regulatory gaps to prevent future failures in the FCM community and enhances nearly every protection afforded customers of FCMs and the futures and cleared swaps markets. Customers will benefit from enhancements to FCM risk management programs, modernized audit programs, and streamlined measures that will better insulate customers from fellow customer risk. The residual interest provisions have been the most discussed part of the proposal. The Commission received a significant number of comment letters in response to that proposal, which would have required FCMs to maintain at all times enough residual interest in their segregated accounts to cover all customer margin deficits. That approach was intended to limit fellow customer risk by ensuring that one customer would in no circumstance be responsible for unwittingly covering another customer's margin obligations. Although the proposal offered one permissible construction of the Commodity Exchange Act, it suffered from some practical shortcomings. Those practical shortcomings, in my judgment, are appropriately addressed in the document before us today. For example, many suggested that the at all times requirement under the proposal likely would have imposed significant capital costs on FCMs, which could have led to the unintended effect of limiting access to the derivatives markets. Many contended that this would be too high a price to pay when measured against the corresponding benefit of mitigating fellow customer risks. The Commission has considered these comments and has taken a different approach in today's release. The compromise reflected in the final rule is intended to usher in improvements to margin collection practices over time and to protect access to the markets for a broad cross-section of participants. It will better protect the excess segregation funds of a customer in the event of an FCM bankruptcy. It also will encourage FCMs to more actively monitor customer accounts for instances when those accounts are undermargined. And finally, it will incentivize FCMs to address those circumstances when an account is undermargined. Together, these enhancements will better protect the safety and soundness of the FCM. Importantly, the Commission has given itself sufficient time to evaluate the FCM community's progress in implementing the residual interest policy in the final rule and to change course if necessary. Indeed, the phase compliance schedule provided in today's release was a critical component of getting to this final compromise on residual interest. That compromise is reasonable and measured. For 1 year, there will be no change to current practice with respect to the treatment of residual interest. After that year, FCMs will be required to comply with the residual interest requirement as of the close of business on the day following the margin deficit calculation. This is a necessary and significant change to current market practice. 30 months after today's release is published, Commission staff is obligated to conduct a study determining the feasibility, costs, and benefits of moving the residual interest deadline to the completion of the first clearing settlement cycle following the trade day. The study will be published for public comment, and a public roundtable will be held to solicit the views of market participants. Finally, after 5 years, the residual interest requirement will move up to the first clearing settlement cycle of the day, typically first thing in the morning, should the commission choose not to change course based upon recommendations in the study or in reaction to public feedback at the roundtable. To be sure, if this in-state were implemented today, it would no doubt create a significant cost to FCMs and to market participants. The five-year phase-in period, however, provides the industry an opportunity to streamline margin collection practices and to take advantage of any technological solutions that may be developed in the meantime. Equally important, today's release ensures that future residual interest requirements will not be imposed on the FCM community if the facts on the ground regarding feasibility and cost do not support it. It is important to note that the study and roundtable are not optional, but rather mandated by law, which means that the newly updated information will be brought to the Commission before the phase-in period would end. If the Commission decides that it is appropriate to change the residual interest deadline, the Commission may act nimbly and implement a new compliance schedule for that deadline by order, without the procedural hurdles of notice and comment. I'm confident that if the Commission is presented with convincing facts through this process, it will be compelled to respond appropriately. All stakeholders in today's release, including policymakers, FCMs, and their customers, rightly anticipate that new services and technologies will provide solutions to today's compliance challenges. I know that all of us not only welcome those advancements, but hope they are brought to market as quickly as practicable. The approach of this rulemaking appropriately incentivizes that outcome. For that reason, I anticipate that technological solutions will facilitate compliance with residual interest requirements in the near future for those who could not comply today. I must point out that the comment filed to this rule suggests that the vast majority of the marketplace could comply with more abbreviated timelines for margin calls and payments today. I also anticipate that the flexibility built into this rule will help avoid the less desirable alternative methods of compliance suggested by commenters, including self-funding or pre-funding residual interest or margin obligations, as some have predicted. To be more clear, I strongly prefer and indeed expect that FCMs will not pursue these options in order to comply with today's release. This judgment is based in part on the rapid advancement in settlement solutions in recent years, as well as the fact that the latter options may not, all things considered, be as commercially viable. The expense of pre-funding margin accounts was a special concern of the agricultural community raised in their comments. I spent many days with agricultural producers over the last several months discussing this issue and others. I met with a number of producers in my home state of Iowa who actively use the derivatives markets to hedge their production risks. I have listened to and carefully considered their concerns about the residual interest requirement. Today's release takes those concerns into account, and I believe that their most pressing fears will not be realized because of this rule. Meanwhile, even today, producers can make intraday margin payments to FCMs through banking or credit relationships once a margin call is received. Based on what I have learned over recent months, these types of relationships are at a minimum common in the producer community and seemingly the norm for large producers. For those producers who do not currently rely on these services, again, I expect other solutions to payment settlement will be offered, or producers will in time embrace those already available with marginal added expense to them. I also would like to clarify that today's release does require FCMs to take a capital charge for failure to meet its residual interest requirement, but this falls on the FCM at the close of business the day after its residual interest obligation. Importantly, today's release phases in the timing of this capital charge obligation until 1 year after its publication in the Federal Register, as some commenters suggested. Again, I'd like to thank the staff for their work in putting together this balanced approach. With the concerns about residual interest properly addressed, I am happy to support the final rule as an important step forward in the Commission's ongoing efforts to protect customers. As a final note, I look forward to taking up the Volcker rule and the position limits proposal by year end, along with a number of Commission determinations on substituted compliance. As I said at the time when we finalized our cross-border guidance, those determinations will benefit from as much transparency as practicable. With that, I look forward to supporting the staff's recommendations on the rule and turn it back over to the chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners Chilton, Amaya, and Weejin. Before I turn it over to the staff, I did want to address at least three other matters. We, this morning, unanimously, as a commission, actually finalized two other rule sets. And since they were noticed for this meeting, I just wanted to inform the public of that. One is one of the five other matters that we did to help customers and protect their funds. It relates to the choice that customers will have to segregate their collateral and funds, which are called initial margins, standing behind swaps that are not cleared. Congress gave a clear right of counterparties of swap dealers that if they chose to have those funds segregated. And I'm pleased to report that we unanimously moved that this morning. And I think that that's a key tenet to customer protection.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, on that point, I'd like to ask the staff a couple of questions about that when we get to the questions.
Absolutely. We have an excellent staff here, and if we need to pull any in, we will.
They're here, and I'm happy to support that proposal, but there are a couple of questions I think we need to look at.
Absolutely. And another rule that we moved was out of the Division of Market Oversight, our chief economist's office, and all of our surveillance teams across the agency, and will help them, is what's called ownership and control reporting. This has been on our docket for 4+ years. We went out with an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, a proposal. We re-proposed it after some staff roundtables, and I'm glad to say we again reached conclusion on that, which I want to thank Commissioner Amaya for his doggedness on this. We will finally have in our rule book that it's required to file these various forms electronically. It will no longer be by mail and fax. I also want to thank staff. Many of the things even in this document today that we're considering is also to file things electronically, which is the right place to be in the 21st century. But also the ownership and control report will give us a greater window into those parties that actually own accounts and control those accounts, not only for positions, but also in the world of high-frequency trading for accounts that have high volume on a particular day but might end the day flat or without a position. So for the first time, we'll have that enhancement and an ability to oversee markets. I said there were three things. I also wanted to, at this moment, give a public thanks to my friend, my colleague, and a wonderful head of the Division of Enforcement, David Meister, because today is, in fact, his last day of service at the CFTC. And David, you've brought tremendous energy, wisdom, talent, yes, expertise from the Southern District of New York. And I think you've shown how it is to be a tough but fair prosecutor. And you've led a remarkable team, often strapped with not enough resources. And I wish you well on whatever your next professional adventures are. So, but with that, I'm supposed to say some things about what we're doing. I, at this point, ask unanimous consent to allow staff to make technical corrections to the documents voted on today prior to sending them to the Federal Register without objection. So ordered. And then I turn it over to Gary Barnett, the head of our Division of Swap Dealer and Intermediary Oversight, Tom Smith, and Kevin Piccoli, two of his key deputies. I know that also here, Anana Radhakrishnan, the head of the Division of Clearing and Risk, and two of his key deputies, Robert Wasserman and Phyllis Dietz, will be reporting, and then Stephen Kane from our Chief Economist's Office. Gary.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm going to turn it over to Tom for our prepared statements.
Could you move that a little closer, because I don't think we hear.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, okay, I can hear that. Staff today is recommending that the Commission adopt as final certain new regulations and amendments to existing regulations that enhance customer protection and the protections for funds that customers deposit with FCMs or are held by DCO. The document that you have before you was prepared by staff in the Division of Swap Dealer and Intermediary Oversight, the Division of Clearing and Risk, and the Office of Chief Economist, with substantial contributions and counsel from many of our colleagues in the Office of General Counsel and the Division of Enforcement. The customer protection rulemaking was published for public comment on November 14, 2012, and was in response to several market events and FCM bankruptcies that highlighted weaknesses in the current regulations and FCM monitoring practices. In developing the customer protection rulemaking, Commission staff conducted a comprehensive assessment of how customers and customer funds could be better protected under the current statutory and regulatory structure through appropriate rulemaking and SRO actions. Over 120 written submissions were received on the proposal, and staff also met with several commenters during the comment process. Staff also has considered information obtained during public roundtables and advisory committee meetings in developing the recommendations that we will discuss today. Staff's recommendations also have been influenced by the actions that SROs have already taken to enhance customer protections. The final regulations reflect the staff's efforts for a comprehensive review of how to enhance customer protections, and the recommendations cover a broad range of areas. Specifically, the final regulations would enhance customer protection by strengthening the requirements on how FCMs and DCOs hold customer funds and record obligations to customers in their books and records, imposing risk management requirements on how FCMs that hold customer funds, revising the SRO and public accounting examination process over FCMs, requiring FCMs to provide additional disclosures to customers and market participants to allow such persons to make a more informed choice regarding participating in the futures markets and in selecting an FCM to entrust their funds, and lastly, requiring FCMs to provide the Commission with additional information to assist with the identification of potential risk to the financial soundness of the FCM and ultimately the protection of customers and customer funds. With respect to providing greater protection to customer funds held by FCMs and DCOs, the final regulations explicitly require an FCM to compute its segregation requirement under Regulation 1.20 using the net liquidating equity method, and further provide that an FCM must hold sufficient funds in segregation at all times to meet the net liquidating equity requirement for all of its futures customers. The net liquidating equity method is computed by aggregating the positive account balances of each customer. This computation ensures that the FCM holds sufficient funds in segregation to meet the full account balances of each customer with a positive account balance. The regulation further provides that an FCM must hold all amounts, hold an amount of funds in segregation to cover the net liquidating equities of all customers at all points in time. End of day compliance is not itself adequate. Now, this was already in the commission's or in the act, but we decided to make it explicit in the regulations, including the actual calculation. The final regulations also revise how FCMs may hold funds for customers trading on foreign markets and compute their obligations to such customers under Part 30 of the commission's regulations. The revisions more closely align the Part 30 requirements with Part 1 requirements for future customers and Part 22 requirements for cleared swaps customers. Specifically, the final regulations eliminate the alternative method of computing the amount of funds an FCM is required to hold in secured accounts for Part 30 customers. Under the alternative method, an FCM is only required to hold in separate customer accounts an amount of funds sufficient to cover the margin required on open foreign futures and foreign option positions, plus or minus any unrealized gains or losses on such positions held by the customers. The final regulation requires an FCM to hold sufficient funds in secured accounts to meet the total net liquidating equities of each of its customers trading on foreign markets. Second, it requires an FCM to include in the account balances of both, to include the account balances of both U.S. domiciled customers and foreign domiciled customers in determining the net liquidating equity of customers trading on foreign markets. Third, it prohibits an FCM from holding a customer's non-futures, foreign futures positions in a Part 30 secured accounts. The final rules also restrict the amount of Part 30 customer funds that an FCM may hold in depositories located outside of the United States to the amount of margin required by foreign carrying brokers or clearing organizations, plus a 20% cushion to allow FCMs to meet their business obligations without the need for daily transfers of customer funds from U.S. depositories. And lastly, it prohibits an FCM from waiving any protections afforded to the deposit and holding of customer funds under the laws or regulations of a foreign jurisdiction. The final regulations also require an FCM to establish a targeted amount of residual interest, i.e. proprietary funds, that the firm will hold in Part 1 and Part 2 customer segregated accounts and Part 30 secured accounts. In determining the targeted residual interest, an FCM must consider all relevant factors impacting the firm's segregated accounts, including the nature of its customer base, trading activities of customers, creditworthiness of customers, and types of futures market traded by the customers in determining the targeted residual interest. The analysis and calculation must be described in writing with specificity necessary to allow the Commission and FCM's DSROs to replicate the calculation and test the assumptions made by the FCM. The analysis and target also must be reassessed periodically by the FCM. If the actual amount of excess funds held in segregated or secured account falls below the target amount, the FCM is required to deposit additional proprietary funds into the accounts prior to the close of the next business day to restore the balance to the targeted level. An FCM is prohibited under the final regulations from withdrawing funds from segregated or secured accounts where such withdrawals are not for the benefit of the FCM's customers, unless the FCM has completed its daily segregation or secured amount computation, and the computation verifies that the FCM holds excess funds in the customer segregated or secured accounts. The regulations also impose an obligation on an FCM's management to actively monitor material withdrawals from customer segregated or secured accounts by requiring that the firm's senior management pre-approve any withdrawal from customer segregated or secured accounts where such withdrawal or series of withdrawals exceeds 25% of the FCM's excess segregated or secured funds and the withdrawal was not made for the benefit of the FCM's customers. FCMs and DCOs also are required to obtain an acknowledgement letter from depositories that hold customer funds. The requirements for the segregation acknowledgement letters will be addressed by my colleagues from DCR. And finally, the regulations have been revised to require an FCM to use proprietary funds to cover under-margin customer futures and Part 30 accounts. This issue also will be addressed by my DCR colleagues. In the area of risk management for FCMs, new regulation 1.11 requires each FCM that holds customer funds to establish and enforce a risk management program designed to monitor and manage the risks associated with the activities of the FCM operating as an FCM. The risk management requirement is based upon existing risk management requirements for swap dealers under commission regulations. The risk management program must be in writing and approved by the governing body of the FCM. The FCM must provide a copy of the risk management program to the commission and to the firm's DSRO, and each FCM must establish a risk management unit with sufficient authority, personnel, financial, operational, and other resources to carry out the risk management program. This risk management unit also must be independent of the business units. Elements of the risk management program are as follows. The risk management program must take into account market, credit, liquidity, foreign currency, legal, operational, settlement, segregation, technological, capital, and other applicable risk, together with a description of the risk tolerance limits. Risk tolerance limits must be reviewed and approved quarterly by senior management and annually by the governing body of the FCM, and the risk management report must take into account risk posed by affiliates, all lines of business of the FCM, and all other trading activity engaged in by the FCM, and must be integrated into risk management at the consolidated level. The risk management unit of the FCM must provide senior management of the FCM and the governing body with quarterly reports setting forth applicable risk exposures of the FCM and any recommendations regarding changes to the program. The regulations require that the risk management program be reviewed and tested on at least an annual basis or upon material changes that alter the risk profile of the firm, with results reported to the chief compliance officer, senior management, and the governing body of the FCM. The final regulations also include amendments to the Commission's capital rules that will assist or enhance FCM risk management programs. First, the regulations require an FCM to demonstrate upon a request of the Commission with verifiable evidence that the FCM has access to sufficient liquidity to continue to operate as a going concern. The capital regulation is also revised to reduce the period of time that a margin call to a customer, non-customer, or omnibus account holder can be outstanding before the FCM must take an under-margin capital charge. Current regulations require that the FCM take a capital charge for customer accounts if the margin call is not met within 3 days of the issuance of the call. Non-customer and omnibus accounts are subject to an under-margin charge after 2 business days. Thus, for customer accounts that are under margin at the close of business on Monday, an FCM would issue a margin call on Tuesday and take a capital charge at the close of business Friday if the margin call was not met by the customer. The revised regulations require the FCM to take a capital charge for customer, non-customer, and omnibus accounts if Tuesday's margin call was not met by the close of business on Wednesday. Regarding SRO and public accountants examination process over FCMs, first we'll talk about public accountants. With respect to public accountants and the FCM examination program, staff recommends that the Commission adopt this final several amendments that will result in the strengthening of the overall oversight of FCM's compliance with Commission and SRO minimum financial and related reporting requirements. For public accountants, the final regulations impose requirements that are intended to strengthen the quality of the auditors that are permitted to conduct audits of FCM. The regulations retain a current requirement that the public accountant must be in good standing with the appropriate state licensing authority. The final regulations, however, further require that the public accountant must be registered with the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and have undergone an inspection by the PCAOB. The regulations also require a public accountant to conduct its audits of FCMs using the audit standards issued by the PCAOB. Lastly, the public accountant may not be subject to a PCAOB-imposed temporary or permanent bar resulting from a PCAOB disciplinary hearing. The PCAOB registration and inspection requirements enhance customer protections as the PCAOB conducts a continuing program of inspection to assess the degree of compliance of each registered public accounting firm with the rules of the PCAOB, the rules of the SEC, or professional standards in connection with the performance of its audits. The PCAOB also is under the direct oversight of the SEC, which approves its regulations. In addition to the above, the regulations also require an FCM's governing body to conduct a separate assessment of otherwise qualified public accountants. The regulations require the governing body to consider, among other factors, the CPA's experience in auditing FCMs, the CPA's knowledge of the Commodity Exchange Act and regulations, and the depth of the CPA's staff. Such a requirement helps to ensure that an FCM's governing body is actively participating in the appointment of a public accountant to examine the financial statements of an FCM. With respect to the SRO examination program, the current regulations require SROs to adopt rules imposing minimum financial and related reporting requirements. The amended regulations expand the SRO's role and oversight of FCMs, which will enhance protections of customers and, more generally, market participants. Specifically, the regulations require SROs to adopt rules prescribing risk management requirements for member FCMs. Such risk management requirements must be at least as stringent as the requirements contained in new regulation 1.11. Each SRO also is required to establish and operate a supervisory program that includes written policies and procedures for the purposes of assessing a member FCM's compliance with SRO and Commission minimum capital and financial reporting requirements, the obligation to properly segregate customer funds, risk management requirements, record keeping, sales practices, and other compliance requirements. The supervisory program must be based on controls testing and substantive testing and must address all areas of risk to which the FCM can reasonably be foreseen to be subject. The examination of each FCM must be based on the risk profile of each member FCM. The SRO also is required to file a copy of the supervisory program with the commission. The supervisory program must conform to auditing standards issued by the PCAOB, including standards regarding training of staff, planning and supervision of examination, and documentation of examination evidence. To assess the adequacy of the supervisory program, an SRO is required to engage an examinations expert, which is defined as a nationally recognized accounting or auditing firm that has experience in the audit of FCMs and is acceptable to the commission. The SRO is required to have the examinations expert evaluate the supervisory program at least once every 3 years. The SRO is required to obtain a written report from the examinations expert on the findings and recommendations that includes a statement that the examinations expert has evaluated the supervisory program, including the sufficiency of the risk-based approach and the internal controls testing and the application of the supervisory program by the SRO. The written report must also include an analysis of the supervisory program's design to detect material weaknesses in an entity's internal control environment and contain a discussion of any recommendations of new or best practices as described by industry sources, including but not limited to those from the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, the Institute of Internal Auditors, and the Risk Management Association. Finally, the final regulations continue to provide that any two or more SROs may file with the Commission a plan for delegating to a DSRO the function of monitoring and examining an FCM that is a member of both SROs. Switching to additional disclosures to customers. With respect to providing customers with additional risk disclosures, the final regulations include additional risk disclosures that are intended to enhance customer protections by providing customers and prospective customers with additional information regarding the risks of engaging in futures transaction. The final regulations are directly drawn from staff's experience with customers impacted by the bankruptcies of MF Global and are designed to address specific misconceptions that customers had regarding the protections that were received in the event of an FCM bankruptcy. The new disclosures include statements that 1. Customers' funds are not protected by private or public insurance generally, and to the extent that a DCO does have a compensation plan, the customer should fully understand the extent of the coverage of such plan. 2. That futures customer funds held in futures accounts by a dual registrant FCMBD are not protected by the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. 3. Customer funds lost by an FCM are not guaranteed by DCOs, and lastly, that customer funds may be commingled with other customer funds by an FCM, i.e., there is no universal individual segregated accounts. Each FCM also is required under Regulation 1.55 to provide customers with additional firm-specific disclosures intended to provide customers with information about the firm that would be relevant to the customer's decision to entrust customer funds with the firm. Such disclosures include general information regarding the FCM, including the name, title, business background, and areas of responsibility of each person that is defined as a principal of the firm, the types of businesses the FCM engages in, the material risk of entrusting customer funds to the FCM, including the nature of investments made by the FCM with customer funds, and any material administrative, civil, enforcement, or criminal complaints or actions filed against the FCM that have not concluded. The regulation also requires each FCM to place on its website financial information that would be available to customers and potential customers. This would include daily segregation computations, monthly financial statement data, and certain statements and schedules from the firm's certified annual report. Additional information that FCMs will be required to report to the commission under the final rules include amending the financial reporting by requiring by FCMs to prepare a new cleared swap segregation schedule and to require that all segregation and secured schedules report targeted residual interest levels. Amending Regulation 1.32 to require an FCM to file its daily segregation schedules with the Commission and with the firm's DSRO each business day in electronic format. amending Regulation 1.10 to revise the Form 1FR FCM balance sheet to provide transparent reporting of the FCM's assets and liabilities to cleared swap customers and liabilities to retail foreign exchange customers, and the amount of funds in designated accounts to meet the FCM's obligation to retail Forex customers as required by Regulation 5.8. Amending Regulation 1.10 to reduce the time frame for standalone FCMs to file their certified annual reports from 90 days to 60 days after the year-end date. Amending Regulation 1.10 to require each FCM to provide a calculation of its leverage ratio to the Commission on a monthly basis. And lastly, requiring FCMs to provide additional regulatory notices under Regulation 1.12 to provide a more effective early warning system, including notice of a violation of the standards for permitted investments under Regulation 1.25, notice of a violation of the segregation requirement for cleared swap transactions, and thirdly, notice of a material adverse event at an FCM. That concludes the discussion of the customer protection rulemaking, and I can pass it over to my DCR colleagues for SEG acknowledgement letters and for residual interest.
Thank you. Before I hand it over to my colleagues, I think it'd be very illuminating for members of the public for me to read Section 4D of the Commodity Exchange Act, because as Commissioner Chilton correctly pointed out, we have to administer the law. I'm not saying that the Commission does not, but it'd be interesting, it'd be good for the public to know and for the record to know what the section says. So I'm not going to read all of it, but just the relevant part. 4, small letter D, says, it shall be unlawful for any person to be a futures commission merchant unless you're registered as such with the CFTC. That makes a lot of sense. And your registration has not been expired or has been suspended. Also makes a lot of sense. Second, that person, that FCM, shall treat and deal with all money, securities, and property received by such person, i.e. the FCM, to margin, guarantee, or secure the trades or contracts of any customer of such person, or accruing to such customer as the result of such trades or contracts as belonging to such customer. Further goes on to say, such money, securities, and property shall be separately accounted for and shall not be commingled with the funds of such commission merchant, here's the punchline, or be used to margin or guarantee the trades or contracts, or to secure or extend the credit of any customer or person other than the one for whom the same are held. In other words, you don't use A's money to margin, secure, or guarantee the contracts of B. So it's important to keep that in mind in the context of the rules that the Commission is considering today. I'm going to hand it over to Phyllis Dietz, who's going to talk about acknowledgement letters that FCMs and DCOs are obliged to get from depositories, and then Bob will talk about the residual interest proposal. Thank you.
Good morning. The customer protection final rulemaking before the Commission includes amended regulations governing the acknowledgement letters that FCMs and DCOs must obtain from depositories holding customer funds. The purpose of the acknowledgement letters is to put the depository on notice that the funds held in the customer account must be treated in accordance with applicable segregation requirements under the Act and Commission regulations. The regulations, among other things, require the use of a template letter that is included in the appendices of the specific regulations, 1.20, template letters for futures and cleared swaps, 1.26, letters for investments of customer funds, and 30.7 relating to secured amounts. There are a total of 6 letters, 4 to be used by FCMs and 2 to be used by DCOs. Certain provisions of the letters are identical, but there are differences among the letters to accommodate their usage in connection with different customer accounts. In addition to acknowledging the segregation requirements applicable to the FCM or DCO customer account, the letters include provisions that enhance the Commission's ability to identify and respond to potential problems in the treatment of customer funds by FCMs, DCOs, or the depositories themselves. For example, the FCMs in their letters authorize the depository to reply promptly and directly to requests for account information from the CFTC or the FCM's DSRO, to provide the CFTC with read-only access to transaction and account balance information for customer accounts, and to permit customer accounts to be examined by the CFTC or the FCM's DSRO. I would like to highlight just two provisions in the acknowledgement letter that received a number of public comments. The first is the language related to permissible liens on the customer account. The second is the standard of liability the depository in relying on the applied to the depository in relying on the account holder's representation that the FCM or DCO complies with the Act and CFTC regulations. With respect to liens on the customer account, the final template letters have been modified to incorporate certain recommendations from commenters. The proposed provision permitted a depository to recover funds advanced in the form of cash transfers it makes in lieu of liquidating non-cash assets held in the account for purposes of variation settlement or posting initial margin. So that we do not unintentionally exclude similar situations that would be permissible within the same legal construct, the final letters now provide that the depository has the right to recover funds advanced in the form of cash transfers, repurchase agreements, or other similar liquidity arrangements the depository makes, in lieu of liquidating non-cash assets, which as proposed, and now, in response to commenters, in lieu of converting cash held in the account to cash in a different currency. We have also eliminated the specific references to the use of the funds for variation settlement or posting initial margin because it is implicit that the uses can only be legally permitted ones, and we do not want to unintentionally limit otherwise permissible practices. As a final matter, I note that we have not changed our position that the depository may not extend credit to the FCM and take a lien on the customer account. This includes extending credit to the FCM to fulfill the FCM's obligation to a DCO to post customer margin. With respect to the standard of liability provision and the depository's contractual reliance on the FCM or DCO account holder to comply with the customer fund segregation requirements, we have modified the standard of liability provision to now provide: the depository may conclusively presume that any withdrawal from the accounts and the balances maintained therein are in conformity with the Act and CFTC regulations without any further inquiry, provided that, in the ordinary course of the depository's business as a depository, it has no notice or actual knowledge of a potential violation by the FCM or DCO account holder of any provision of the Act or the CFTC regulations that relates to the segregation of customer funds. And then unchanged is the following clause, and the depository shall not in any manner, not expressly agreed to in the letter, be responsible to the FCM or DCO account holder for ensuring compliance by that account holder with the provisions of the Act or CFTC regulations. Among the changes is the removal of the proposed language that would have held the depository to the additional standard of could not reasonably know of a violation of the Act, which commenters said would greatly expand the scope of the depository's responsibility for the actions of its account holders and would create uncertainty as to the level of additional diligence that would be necessary to meet this standard. As an additional matter, we have added a clause providing that the conclusive presumption of the FCM or DCO's compliance does not affect any obligation the depository may otherwise have under the Act or CFTC regulations. This distinguishes between the contractual standard and the new or should have known standard to which the Commission would hold a depository under the Act and CFTC regulations, and which is independent of anything in the template letters. That concludes my summary. Thank you.
Thank you. As the Chairman and Tom just discussed, in the aftermath of MF Global, staff undertook a comprehensive analysis of customer protection. And one issue we identified was a tension between current practice with respect to customer margin deficits and the requirements of Section 4D of the Act that Ananda just read out to us. I should note that there is a distinction between a debit balance, and that's where the customer actually has a negative balance and owes the FCM money, and a margin deficit. And that's where a customer has a positive balance. So if I, as the customer, have $80 in my account, but the margin requirement for my positions is $100, I have a positive balance, but I have a margin deficit. So in terms of the statutory requirement, I guess one way of looking at this is that an FCM is prohibited from using Peter's margin surplus to cover Paul's margin deficit. Using the context, you're not supposed to rob Peter to pay Paul. And there's an inescapable mathematical fact. The margin a DCO requires to collateralize Paul's positions comes from one of only three possible sources. It either comes from Paul himself, but if Paul's undermargined, then he hasn't been able to do that. It comes from the FCM's own capital, which capital, when deposited in segregation, we're referring to here as the residual interest. Or it's got to come from the excess margin of other FCM customers, who I'm referring to here as Peter. And 4D says that that's simply not supposed to happen. The question comes up, well, what's the harm? Why do we care if we collateralize Paul's positions with Peter's excess collateral? The harm comes if the FCM enters into bankruptcy. And indeed, it's that concern that animates all of our segregation rules. So the FCM is in bankruptcy. Peter's excess is being used at the clearinghouse to margin Paul's positions. Then it's not available to be transferred for the benefit of Peter. It is going to be retained by the clearinghouse to protect itself, or if Paul's positions are transferred, they'll be accompanied by the required collateral, some of which came from Peter. And if Paul's positions lose money, then Peter may be permanently out of pocket until and unless the trustee recovers from Paul. Now, Congress enacted this prohibition back in 1936 in response to concerns that FCMs were using the margin taken from one class of customers to extend credit for margin for the trades of others. So indeed, we have in the congressional record that concern expressed by Senator Pope of Idaho. And indeed, the original regulations enacted in 1937 provided that the net equity of one customer shall not be used to carry the trades or contracts or to offset the net deficit of any other customer or person. In other words, the prohibition applied not only to offsetting net deficits of other customers, but also to something else, carrying the trades of other customers. Now, reference to net equity was dropped in 1981 regulatory changes addressing options, and we looked, and neither the adopting release nor the proposing release indicated any intent to actually alter or modify these existing segregation requirements for futures. Now, the rule proposal back in 2012 noted that this requirement applies, quote, at all times. And as I'll discuss further below, commenters based many of their calculations of costs on that language, that it's the at all times requirement that was causing particular problems. Commenters discussed the practical difficulties of a continuous calculation requirement, describing it as a constantly moving target. Other commenters pointed out that customer collateral isn't really used until settlement. And indeed, when we look at the statutory prohibition, the prohibition is on use. And so if Paul's trading generates an increased margin requirement on Monday, the margin would not be sent upstream to the clearinghouse. It would not be used until settlement on Tuesday morning. And so a point-in-time approach removes what one commenter described as the predictive element of FCM funding requirements. That is, there's no need to maintain real-time funding as markets are moving constantly, creating gains and losses. And this point-in-time approach permits markets to, as the commenters noted, reap the efficiencies of end-of-day accounting. Now, industry commenters noted that a point-in-time approach with a deadline of end-of-day on T plus one, in our example, covering Monday's margin deficit, which is paid Tuesday morning by end-of-day on Tuesday, would minimize these costs. A few other commenters suggested that the correct approach was the one consistent with the approach currently being followed in the swaps context under LSOC, which with residual interest covered by the time of settlement. A number of commenters urged that addressing these issues would require years to implement, and others urged further study of the effects of these changes. The draft before you draws from a number of these suggestions. The implementation scheme in that draft is designed to balance respect for the statutory requirement of avoiding the use of one's customer's collateral to margin another customer's positions with the goal of being sensitive to costs. It follows an implementation schedule that is parallel to that adopted by the Commission for setting the de minimis amount for swap dealing in the entities definition. And so, broadly, 122C1 requires a calculation of each customer's under-margin amount, if any, based on a comparison of collateral required for the customer's positions versus the customer's net liquidating equity. Margin required, what the customer has. C2 requires each FCM to calculate, based on the information available to the FCM at the close of each business day, the under-margin amounts calculated based on the clearing initial margin that would be required for the next day's settlements. And again, that information is calculated based on the information available to the FCM at the close of the business day. C3 requires the FCM to maintain, by the residual interest deadline, residual interest in seg funds that is at least equal to the computation set forth in C2, but reduced to take into account payments received from under-margin customers before that deadline. So in other words, you're making the calculation based on the information available at close of business Monday, you get to take into account payments that you receive after that point before the residual interest deadline. And that residual interest deadline is defined in C5. Starting 1 year after publication, the deadline would be 6 p.m. on T plus one, consistent with some of the commenter suggestions. So in other words, 6 p.m. on Tuesday. Absent contrary action by the Commission, the residual interest deadline moves on December 31st, 2018, that is in about 5 years, to the time of settlement, which is essentially where the statute points us and was noted by some other commenters. Now, I should note before I go on that the proposal before you benefits from information provided in the comments about costs and a very detailed cost-benefit analysis. But in addition to that, the staff is directed to complete and publish for public comment a report addressing the practicability for both FCMs and customers of this move, that is, of moving the deadline from 6 p.m. to the time of settlement or to some other time of day, including whether and on what schedule it would be feasible to do so and the costs and benefits of those potential requirements. And the deadline for that report is in 2.5 years. 9 months after publication of that report, the Commission may terminate the phase-in period, but on no less than a year's notice. That would bring that 5-year deadline in somewhat, although when you add it all up, it could be really by no more than about 9 months. Or to determine to propose through rulemaking a different residual interest deadline, in which case the Commission shall establish by order a phase-in schedule. So that phase-in schedule, in other words, would be with the proposal, but would not need to wait until a final adoption for that new phase-in schedule to be established by order. I should note also that the residual interest requirements set forth in 122C overlap with the targeted residual interest that Tom was discussing in 123. And so, for instance, if an FCM has a target residual interest amount of $800,000 and they meet that target, and an aggregate of under margin amounts of $600,000, that's to say something less, then they would not need to maintain, as a result of this rule, 122C, anything more in the way of residual interest than the amount they're already maintaining. In other words, there's an overlap here, and so we really shouldn't double count. If the target were, say, $700,000, but their requirement, after considering the payments coming in from under margin customers, were $1 million, then they would need to add that $300,000 to top up. In summary, we've endeavored to balance the statutory provision prohibiting the use of one customer's margin to guarantee another's positions with an implementation path that is designed to be as practicable as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. I will now entertain a motion to accept the staff recommendation concerning customer protection. And is there a second? There's a second. As I said, I'm going to support these rules. I do have a few questions, if I can, just for the record. First is, there's three different types of accounts that we now have in our regulatory regime. And I better make sure I'm right about this, but domestic futures, if I can say it in a colloquial way, is that right? So it's under this Part 4D. Foreign futures under Part 30. Is that right, Ananda? Right?
Correct.
And then something called a cleared swaps account. Is that?
Correct.
And that's Part 22. Is that about right?
Correct.
So there's three different types of accounts that if a dealer, I'm sorry, an FCM goes into bankruptcy, need to be protected and segregated. So my question for you, if I go through the six things that were in my opening statement, can you just tell me, do we cover all three accounts or is it covered somewhere else? So that's going to be, I just want to make sure. So we have enhanced in these rules significantly the supervision and accounting for all of the customer funds. I think it's in Section 111 and elsewhere, I mean, throughout. Does that, all of that we do, Kevin Bacoli, Tom Smith, cover all three of the types of accounts?
Yes, it covers all three.
All right. I think I know the answers, but I just want to make sure I get this. We've, in these rules, if we adopt them, have significant enhancements about outside accountants and outside auditors and the CPA and what the self-regulatory organizations need to do. Will that cover all three types of accounts?
Yes, it goes to the firm, so it covers all three accounts.
Okay. We've, of course, done something about foreign futures accounts and changed a lot about foreign futures. So I guess that only goes to foreign futures, or does that go to the others as well?
It goes only to foreign futures, and it aligns it more closely with the domestic accounts and cleared swaps.
Now I'm getting to the little trickier ones. We have a lot, and I can't remember the sections, about acknowledgement letters that Phyllis did, and also about the movement of money, that if you're going to take more than 25% out of what's called the residual interest, a senior officer has to sign some paperwork and so forth, whether it's in acknowledgement letters or the movement of monies. Does that go to all three types of accounts?
Yes, with respect to the segregation letters, it's all three accounts, and with respect to the movement of funds and 25% restrictions, it's all three accounts.
All right. With transparency, we have a lot in here about transparency, the transparency that regulators can see on a daily basis, the accounts at the custodials, but also that the public gets every 15 days some transparency. Do those two pieces of transparency go to all three accounts?
Yes.
All right, we're pretty good so far. Now we have the hard one, Ananda, maybe. This whole issue of residual interest and capital the FCM has to have, and whether they're collecting margin in one day or 3 days, these related issues. Bob or Ananda.
So I'll let Tom speak to the capital point. With respect to the residual interest requirement, I discussed what the requirement is with respect to Part 1, the domestic futures. With respect to cleared swaps, in the implementation of the cleared swaps customer collateral rules last year, we had the opportunity to get folks doing it right as the system was being built, including through working with industry and a staff interpretation. And so that is already there. And so for them, there's no change to be made because they're already there. With respect to Part 30, that is to say at time of settlement.
Before you get to Part 30, so for cleared swaps accounts, based upon the rules this commission adopted in Part 22 and various interpretations subsequent, you're saying it's already at, as you call it, time of settlement, so that Peter can't use Paul's money.
Yeah, just so.
Okay. That's where we might get to in 5 years for these other accounts,
yeah.
Or is it? I'm sorry, I interrupted. Will you do the foreign futures and the domestic futures?
Right. So with respect to the foreign futures, we have two differences. One, you don't have the same statutory requirement, so we're not essentially bound by the statute there. On the other hand, we have, as has been discussed here, a desire to try and keep things somewhat consistent between the various models. Moreover, you've got an additional complication with foreign futures, which is the clock as the world turns. And so if you were going to try and get things done by time of settlement in Europe, it would need to be in the middle of the night. And in Asia, it would need to be the prior evening. And so because of those practical issues and because of the statutory difference, staff proposed that we stop at 6 p.m. Eastern time with respect to foreign futures.
So I take it that cleared swaps, we've already, through rule and interpretation and industry practice, are at the settlement time, which is in essence the next morning.
Right.
For foreign futures, we have the 6 p.m. cutoff. And for domestic futures, we have the 6 p.m. cutoff for 5 years and a study and so forth, which in December of 2018, unless the commission acts otherwise, would go to the settlement time.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And was there some, I'm sorry, Tom, did you have something on these three accounts?
Yeah. With respect to the undermargined capital charge that today firms take on the Friday and the example of the account going undermargined on Monday, that applies to the foreign futures Part 30 account and to the 4D SEG account. It does not apply to the Part 22 cleared swaps account. That was included in the commission's proposed amendments to the swap dealer capital rules. And we incorporated that in the FCM requirements because FCMs could be swap dealers. So that's something that staff still has to complete.
I see. So that's still an open item until the commission completes capital rules
that's
for
correct.
Swap dealers. So that's a yet to be addressed because it's open.
Correct.
In another docket.
Yes.
I thank you. I have a question about acknowledgement letters, and I don't know if anybody from the Division of Enforcement is here. Maybe not. Well, Phyllis, you get to speak for the Division of Enforcement. Does the Division of Enforcement believe that these acknowledgement letters are where they want it to be and that they work and sufficiently protect customer funds?
Yes, they are comfortable with that, and we've fully vetted this. I should actually thank the Division of Enforcement and the Office of General Counsel for their consultation on this. Yes, they are comfortable.
Carlene, anything you want to add, or you're good. All right. Then I wanted to turn to this topic of residual interest and just thank the staff. I have to say, I did not, when we proposed this, anticipate as much of debate. But that's why it's good to have an Administrative Procedures Act and that we go out and we get, I think we've benefited greatly from this discussion and debate. The reason I say I didn't anticipate quite the activity is because the law seems, as Ananda read, quite clear that one's not to use one account, as Bob Wasserman said, Peter's money for Paul, or was it Paul for Peter? And I was very glad that we were able to benefit from so much input about this, and there's a clear statement in the document as a threshold matter. I'm reading page 175, but it's in the preamble. And as noted above, the commission reiterates that the act expressly prohibits an FCM from using the collateral of one customer to margin, secure, or guarantee the trades or contracts of other customers. And then the remarkable work, Jonathan, a shout out to whomever in the Office of General Counsel or the Division of Clearing Arrests who did this research of the 1930s and got Senator Pope's statements and the head of the Grain Futures Administration statement. So, what's that?
That was Evan Waterman in OGC who did some really, really excellent, almost archaeological research.
I thank Evan for that. Because it really is, as Commissioner Chilton says, what is the law, and then how does that affect customers? And I think that there is a good balancing of the statute and the practical realities of the marketplace with this five-year phase-in. And I think that that really is, as Commissioner Wiegand said, I think his words were a compromise, but I think it's the right balance with a lot more study and roundtables and a commission that can still take action 3 to 4 years from now based on that study. And as technology continues to change, technology is very different today than the 1930s, but it will again be different in 4 years as well. And I'm struck, as Commissioner Wiegand said, but I'll ask the staff about his comment about that. Actually, because of technology, a lot of counterparties and customers are able to do their margin calls and even before the 6 p.m. at this point in time. Is that as we understand it?
That's our understanding. There's something called wire transfer.
What's that? I'm sorry.
There's something called a wire transfer.
Wire transfer money.
Yeah. You don't need to write a check anymore. You just transfer money through wire. So.
But I do think leaving it right now at the 5 years is good. David Meister, Division of Enforcement, are you all right with the acknowledgement letters? We are. One of his last statements at a commission meeting. So then I move to my last question, and then I'll turn it over to my fellow commissioners. If you were discussing this with a farmer or a rancher or my mom, and you just think about, not Peter and Paul, but think about two events of the last 2 years, the failings at Peregrine and MF Global. And my mom only knows what she reads in the newspapers. How do these rules help protect against the future circumstances of those situations, the whole package? And I'm not looking for the detail of what 1.22 says and things like that, but if you just like, how do these rules in combination help protect the public and protect the investing and hedging public, the farmer, the rancher, from these events in the future? Gary Barnett or Ananda?
Sure. I think the focus now on internal control and the emphasis on internal risk management is a huge mitigant to risk. Some of the things we saw during the two crises, if we'd had this sort of separation of duties and the internal policies and procedures, would have helped mitigate some of those risks that we saw. Also giving us, changing our orientation in terms of examinations and oversight, getting ahead of the problem, seeing around corners a little better, more forward-looking notices and so on, being more proactive on supervising problem situations before they occur, and so we can be more on the spot. Those sorts of things will really reduce the level of risk, I think.
I'd agree with Gary. I think what the two events caused us to do was to examine practices in the industry. So if you think about the two events, Peregrine in my view, was a misappropriation of theft. I'm not speaking for the Division of Enforcement, but and MF Global, it wasn't really a market-driven event in that it was not an event in our markets. Right? People at MF Global were doing things in markets that this commission does not regulate, and there was a spillover, and there was a requirement for liquidity, and for reasons best known to themselves, they decided that customer segregated funds would be that source of liquidity, you know, in violation of the law, in my opinion. But what it did do was to cause us to examine the industry and to propose rules that we believe would strengthen, and you know, DCR is completely in support of the, you know, the DSIO part of the rules. And also, I guess, in the context of Section 4D2, I'll speak for DCR, we assume people understood the law. I guess we were wrong in our assumption because people either didn't understand the law or had a different view of the law. And I want to address issues raised by commenters that we are changing our interpretation of the law. We are not changing our interpretation of the law. If at all, you know, as the record suggests, we are iterating or reiterating our long-held position on the law. The language of the statute is very clear.
But can I simplify? You think that, this is a yes or no, it would be, I'm hoping it's a yes, that it would be way harder to do what Russ Wassendorf did at Peregrine, to forge statements, to do that which we found in Peregrine.
Yes,
I agree.
Would it be harder that if a firm was going into crisis because of their various trading positions across the globe to possibly reach in to customer funds to find, as Ananda said, and it's on the record, to find liquidity as you're going into crisis? Would these rules make that, you know,
yes,
near hopefully near to impossible, but... Kevin Auditor. McCauley, you want to? You push the mic?
Yep. No, I agree. I think these rules will make it very, very difficult.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Chilton.
That was a really good exchange, Mr. Chairman, because all too often, you know, we're down in the weeds and nobody understands really out in the countryside. The people who are the folks that really were trying to benefit understand these things, and you all gave really great answers. I want to dig in just a little bit more on the same type of answer for residual interest. So why should customers care about this residual interest provision? Mr. Wasserman, if you could do this one. Just you did a real good job, by the way, in your opening statement, but just specifically to that one and make it truncated.
Sure. And I would note that some months ago, there was a meeting with the public, I think it might have been Ag Advisory Committee, and this issue came up. And the question was asked, you know, okay, so who would like to have their excess used to margin someone else's positions? And oddly enough, no hands went up. And so, I mean, that's the issue, because again, when the ball drops, in the event of an insolvency, and if the money is being used, again, if Peter's money is being used for Paul, it's not there for Peter. And Peter's going to want it, and he wants it right now. And the statute tells us we need to take steps to make sure that it's going to be there when he needs it.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Wasserman, also, so what have we done here in this final rule to try to ensure that it's not overly costly for smaller FCMs in particular, some of them that we've heard from, you know, during the waning days of our comment period?
And I think there's two things. One is, again, we've made clear that this is not a continuous requirement, that it is a point-in-time requirement. And so this concept of, well, look, we're going to have to worry all day Monday as the market's going up and down. Is there enough money there? No, it's a point-in-time requirement. Plus, we have what I think is a fairly lengthy implementation period. And so, in other words, nothing happens for 1 year. And then until 2018, 5 years from now, that's when, absent further commission action, the full rigor gets applied. And so there is time for folks to get used to this, to implement changes. And also, as has been pointed out, the technology is changing every day. And certainly, you know, it used to be if I wanted to move money, I had to write a check and put it in the mail. And now, what is the phrase? There's an app for that. And so I think that's what we've been seeing in just the past few years. I rather expect, even out broader than our industry, just in the payments and the banking industry more generally, there's going to be yet further advances. And as well, I think this would create as an impetus for our industry to get more timely and to up their game in terms of essentially information flow and funds flow to meet what are, again, in, you know, in each, in this case, Paul's obligations.
So, you know, when we do these things, you do them based upon the intel and the knowledge that you have at the time, and you can't tell the future. I mean, in the future, Peter could marry Paul, they could harmonize and have one account. We could have flying guitars in 5 years. Wouldn't that be cool? So we don't know. We're making our best determinations. This is a little, and I'm throwing this one to you without having any knowledge of what you might say, but Ananda, when you talked about, you know, wire transfers and these things could be made during the day. So if you're looking at one, this is in the weeds, so I apologize for people, but if you're looking at C3, the provision that says you don't actually have to pay it until 6 p.m. the next day. Yeah, this is after the 5 years. So, yeah, you could make the wire payment in the morning, but since you don't have to pay it until the end of the day, because maybe you won't have that requirement, because C3 says that if you make up the money, correct me if I'm wrong, if you make up the money, and so you, if at one day at 6 o'clock, you have this, you have such and such of a margin call. 23 hours later, maybe you don't have as much of a margin call. So you don't actually have to pay the amount that you owed the previous evening. You could tell me why I'm wrong here. But my question, why isn't everybody going to wait till 5:59 before they hit the button that transfers?
So I apologize if I got a bit too much in the weeds and wasn't clear enough. So there's, as I mentioned, there's three potential places. There's the other customers, and that's what we're working to avoid. There's the FCM, and then there's the customer, you know, Paul himself.
Yeah.
And so the point is that if the FCM has not, just before the deadline, gotten payments in from the customers whose positions generated the margin requirement, then it's the FCM's obligation to put in their own money.
Right.
But yeah, the expectation is the FCM would not be putting in their own money until the deadline, because the amount of the FCM's own money that they would have to put in would be going down as they're collecting the money from the customers whose positions are actually generating.
But the customer money is not due till 6 p.m. either, right?
Well, in other words, so during the implementation, it will be 6 p.m.
But yeah, after the 5 years, it'll be in the morning.
After the 5 years, it would be before, essentially, the time of settlement.
We're not specifying when the customer's got to pay.
I'm just saying, why they're going to wait till the end of the time. That's the only thing I'm saying.
That's possible.
You know, you do make an electronic payment on your bank. It says, when do you want to make it? Now it says, you know, what day do you want to make it?
But we also,
my guess is you can say exactly the time you want to make it, and the time that it's going to be is the minute before it's due, in part because it may change that amount. And why would you put more margin in when you might not be required to in 5 minutes?
Why would it change, though? Because that's the call
you
got yesterday.
Maybe this is where I'm incorrect. I thought 22C3 said that you're not required to make it until this time certain, whatever it is, 6 p.m. or the next morning.
So let's talk about this in terms of after the 5 years.
Yeah, okay.
And so the margin call that is going to be made, essentially the payment upstream from the FCM to the DCO. So that happens, let's just call it 9 a.m. So The FCM doesn't have to pay the money up to the DCO until 9 a.m. They're not using the money that they're sending up there until it is actually sent up there. And so the FCM would be collecting money from their under-margin customers. And so essentially there's no harm to anyone, you know, other than obviously the FCM might want it a couple of minutes to get their accounting done before so that they know, in other words, their treasury requirements, how much they're going to have to pull in. So they might incentivize customers to pay it earlier than 1 minute before. But in either event, it's really between Paul, the customer who's generating the requirement, and the FCM when Paul has to pay the FCM. The FCM can say, well, you know what, Paul, I will let you pay me later. The FCM will likely charge for that convenience. Paul might have, you know, if Paul isn't under margin, there's no issue. But in any event, then the FCM will be using either their money or the money of the customer who generated the requirement before that money is used, sent upstream. So there's really no harm. And so during the implementation time, during the 4 year period after the 1 year, that would be at 6 p.m. And so they would have time then to basically implement better systems.
So it's up to the FCM for when the customer actually has to make the payment to them.
Correct, except that, you know, there's another part about you've got to take a capital charge, right? So if the FCM doesn't collect the under-margin amount by 2 days, then there's a capital hit to the FCM. FCM wants to take a capital hit, that's up to it.
Right.
But that's going to be an impact.
Well, and I apologize for going down this little rabbit hole. I'm just trying to think about it. And, you know, I guess theoretically, and I'll stop here. We go back out of the rabbit hole. Theoretically, there could be competition between the FCMs in that, if I require as an FCM that my customers make the payment 3 hours before the FCM has to make the payment, the DCO, but somebody else has a requirement, as long as it's in 5 minutes before my pay. So this may actually be something that could be used, which I'm stumbling upon now, to make people even more competitive. And perhaps not, but I wanted to go down that, as I say, rabbit trail, and I appreciate your perseverance with me.
No, it could be. You're right, because it's all a matter of the discipline that the FCM imposes on its customers.
Yeah.
And one would hope that, you know, with some of the risk management enhancements that we are proposing, that FCMs would be more disciplined than not.
Thanks for entertaining.
I'd make 2 points. First, I should note the total amount that needs to be made up is based on a calculation that's fixed at the close of the previous business day. As to how much it comes from the customer who generated it or the FCM, that is between them. But the point is that this competition that you're referring to, so long as it's based on how much the FCM uses of their money, or the money of the customer who generated the requirement, and not competing based on how much money they're borrowing from Peter to the customer who's has excess.
Yeah, but you're talking about after the fact. You're talking about after the FCM has made the payment. I'm talking about before in collecting it from the customers. The FCM collects it. Some of them say, you know, the rule says the next morning I got to be, you know, even Steven with everybody, but I want the payment by midnight. And another FCM says, well, 6 a.m. is good with me. That's the competition. I'm talking about before the FCM has to be even Steven.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And again, thanks for your perseverance on that.
Thank you, Commissioner Chilton. I just asked a good grace of Commissioner Maia. I just had one question just that occurred to me. We've tried to encourage all four of us, but Commissioner May and I have spent a lot of time on encouraging portfolio margining, particularly in credit derivatives, where we have a jurisdiction over index swaps and the SEC has it over securities-based swaps. And I think we've made some progress there. I just want to ask a broad question. Those market participants that might use one of our account structures, a 4D account or other account, maybe it's a cleared swaps account, to do a portfolio margining that we've allowed in particularly credit derivatives. Would these various reforms be applicable, and would they still benefit in that regard?
Yes. Yes. So it's a function of which account that portfolio margining takes place. So right now you've got portfolio margining programs where DCOs and FCMs portfolio margin in the cleared swaps account. And you also have portfolio margining programs in the cleared futures account. So whichever account that portfolio margining takes place, the rules pertaining to that account will apply.
And it can be a securities, you know, somebody that was putting some securities into that account under those various allowances would still get these the protection of segregation.
Correct.
Yeah, and just on the risk management part of it, that the risk management rule would require risk management of all risks applicable to the FCM business as such. So you slice it all the way down to an issue like that as well.
I thank you. I'm glad we covered that. Commissioner Amaya.
Thank you. I got a couple of questions. I'd like to start with some of the accounting things. So for Tom and Gary, 1.52C2, one little I. Now, we have an SRO obligation to surveil the FCMs and to perform these necessary responsibilities. And in part of their strategies or their oversight responsibilities, they're supposed to do certain things. And in this 152 area, we kind of lay this out. There are a number of areas, though, in this that I'm concerned a little bit about. Vague or unachievable specifics, they lack specifics, and there's some broad goals that they're supposed to adhere to, but it would be very difficult from either surveillance or an oversight or an enforcement standpoint. And there's in this C2 little I, there's a term in here. Let me just read it. It says, a CRO must address all areas of risk to which a futures commission merchant can reasonably be foreseen to be subject. And so obviously they're trying to anticipate the worst, but how are they supposed to address and certify to us that, hey, we've done it. We have foreseen all risk for which a FCM might incur.
Traditional risk enterprise risk management, our own risk management rules under 23600 require an analysis of all risks applicable. And so, you know, you have to analyze the risks of the business, and then you have to assign, you know, risk tolerance limits to it, and then manage it with policies and procedures. It's not a different concept than that. So you have to understand your business, and you have to analyze the risks of that business.
And how should they report it to you?
Is there a report? I mean, is that?
I assume you're going to surveil the SRO for that.
Yeah, I mean, they typically have sort of a risk index they put together, sort of a risk that index the risks of the business. The more granular they can make it, the better they can risk manage the business.
Well, that's my concern. How granular can you be for all risks?
Well,
foreseen.
I think this is in performing any risk analysis of a firm, you always look at the risk profile, and there are a number of very, very good templates out there that people use right now all the time. I think FFIEC has some good templates. IIA has good templates. Risk Management Association has good templates that are out there to guide an examiner or an auditor through an analysis of the risk profile of a firm. And in doing that analysis, they're going to look at the elements of risk and evaluate what is the likelihood of the risk, what are the risk mitigants, and then what is the residual risk or what's remaining after you look at, okay, this is a risk, here are my mitigants or my controls to manage that risk, here's my remaining, my residual risk, and that's where an examiner, an auditor, should be focusing. And that's what we're trying to get to. But those are all very proven, and they've been out in the industry for a long time now. And that's what we're recommending is to adopt.
Okay, those so that's all I wanted to hear from you. As long as they do those types of things, they'll be in compliance and they know what to look for and they, you know, to anticipate every risk. So thank you for bounding that. I mentioned earlier that I want to talk about this segregation of uncleared, the rule that we all signed off on and therefore did not have as part of this agenda. So under 4SL of Dodd, of our rules, which has been in place since the beginning of the year, right? Swap dealers are required to offer segregation of uncleared swap. They're required to offer the third-party segregation. So for the past full 10 months since swap dealers have filed their compliance paperwork, et cetera, we have 89 entities signed up with NFA, and DSIO is pouring through the 180,000 pages of documentation you've requested. I'm interested to know, A, what have swap dealers been offering to their customers already? Because this has already been in place. Our rule does not fundamentally change their obligation. It puts some more specificity on it, but it doesn't change what they've had to offer. And what are customers accepting thus far? I mean, we've had 10 months that they've had to comply with this. So where do we stand on this today?
So I'm not aware of any studies we've done. As you know, Commissioner, we have more than a few resource constraints. I'm not aware of any studies we've done. There is no, in this rule, neither in 4SL nor in this rule, is there a reporting requirement to us. And so I don't know that we've been collecting information that would tell us who's been accepting what based on that.
We that's true. We haven't collected it, but we could get it for you. We could call around and obtain the information for you.
Well, that was kind of the objective of the statute, right? You know, to make sure that customers have at least are informed of this. Okay. Well, I think, you know, I understand the resource constraints. I'd like to talk to you further about, you know, what customers are accepting, and maybe there's a way we can find out without burdening you or anybody else, because obviously if people aren't taking advantage of this, then, you know, what are they doing and how do we protect them? I'm mindful that the NFA has the customer verification and confirmation. If they're putting them in an omnibus account, then would it be make sense to have them hooked up to that? But if they're not putting them and they're commingled, or we just don't know, I guess.
On that point, we would know, because the requirement would not, an omnibus account would not do for this.
But it's not, 4SL is not mandatory either.
That's fair.
Or at least for customers to accept third-party seg. They are only required to be offered it.
Right.
And the dealers could check the box and say, hey, we offered it. Nobody accepted. Where does that leave us? We're talking about customer protection, you know, how important it is and blah, blah, blah. We don't know where customers are in unsegregated, uncleared accounts.
So I would say that based on work with folks over a range of things, including cleared space and the uncleared space, we've heard quite a few folks expressing the view that having segregation of their collateral is very, very important to them. Now, I think it's fairly likely the case that your larger money managers are getting segregation of their bilateral collateral. Indeed, they tell us they are. They've been telling us this for a while. And they've been doing this before 4SL.
Sure.
Because essentially, they have not waited for the swap dealer to say, oh, you have the opportunity to do this. They've told the swap dealer, we're big. You want to do business with us? Here's how it will be, and they've been able to negotiate this.
Historically, we haven't had to worry as much about the big guys getting protection that they want to buy. It's the little guys that I'm concerned about on this one. So let's just figure out where we stand. We've implemented a new rule setting a higher standard than the statute, and we'll just figure out where it is in terms of offerings.
I think you're raising a good point. I don't know because of the resource constraints, but Gary, and maybe working with whether it's Bob's people or what, I think it'd be good to see, you know, some data. I don't think this data is necessarily in the data repositories, because this is whether a bilateral counterparty opts for segregation or not. Anecdotally, Commissioner Malley, I know that many pension funds have told us that they are.
And they've had it before.
But as you say, it's really the hundreds or even thousands of other customers. And so if there's some way to either survey a handful of dealers or the largest dealers and find out, that would be helpful.
We can do that.
Thank you. On this residual interest, so as Ananda says, it's the law today. It's been the law since 1937. It's been in our regs since 1937. Why haven't we enforced it?
I'll defer to the Division of Enforcement to see whether they take an enforcement action. I'm not sure these sort of things came to our attention. So, but, you know, enforcement would like to talk about it, but enforcement action.
So we didn't know about it?
The thing is, you had this law. You assume that people comply with the law. And I imagine that all through the years in the examinations that we took, we had no evidence that people were not complying with the law.
So why are we giving them an extra 5 years to comply with it now? I mean, I know why. We're talking about resources and compliance, but we're clearly looking into this and saying
five-year
delay is an acceptable.
Let the record show that Ananda's recommendation was not the 5 years.
No, my recommendation is...
I happen to support the 5 years, by the way.
Sure, but if you would like, the commission would like to comport the futures rule with the swaps rule, DCA will be fully supportable.
So, I was reading in the rule here, and Commissioner Chilton jogged my memory here in how we've accommodated small FCMs here. And in the document, in the preamble, it says, smaller FCMs may have more difficulty than large FCMs in absorbing the additional costs created by the requirements, particularly Part 122, which is the residual interest. It is possible that some FCMs may elect to stop operating as FCMs as a result of these costs. How much will it cost for FCMs to comply with this rule under our cost-benefit analysis?
And so we've basically looked at costs of capital and multipliers, and we were calculating this industry-wide. And so essentially, I believe was it 3.125% was, I think, the amount?
Well, I'm just looking for the number.
You want to hand it over to Steve? Maybe Steve will answer that. He did a lot of the cost benefit.
So we looked at the different FCMs. The really large ones have a much lower cost of capital than the smaller ones. So to be able to fund the residual interest is going to be a much bigger burden for smaller FCMs, especially if they're not creditworthy. And so it could force them to become introducing brokers. The economics might no longer work.
I would add that we've, through the point in time requirement, as I was discussing with Commissioner Chilton, and the phase-in requirement, endeavored to mitigate the costs. But at the end of the day, we have to be somewhat careful, because we don't want to say, I think, that we're establishing a regime under which customers of smaller FCMs will be less well protected than customers of larger FCMs.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just trying to find. I just asked what it's going to cost them, and you've admitted that the burden on smaller FCMs, regardless of how you want to treat them, is going to be higher. And I'm also interested in small. We've already established earlier in the uncleared seg that the big customers can get big benefits when it comes to dealings with banks. They can get better treatment, third-party segregation for uncleared stuff. Well established, we know that. What about the little guy? How much is this going to cost, this rule going to cost, in terms of if they're required to pre-fund to meet their obligations? And that's what we talk about in this document. Pre-funding is the solution. is really the default solution. Nobody's come up with another specific solution or viable solution other than pre-funding, which if you go to a time of settlement calculation, which apparently was the law, is the law today, but we're delaying it for 5 years. So how much are the little guys going to, what kind of cost are they going to bear?
So to address that kind of question, you need proprietary information from the FCMs. You're talking about a particular market segment. You would have to see how they would respond to changes in fees versus higher pre-funding requirements. And so if you were in the marketing department, you would do some test marketing to assess the sensitivity of customers. But I don't know how we're going to do that as a commission.
So we haven't done it thus far?
No.
To come to our conclusion that we already have. All right.
Can I just ask permission? You lay this out on page 370, but 375, just to put in the record, the answer in the aggregate, not necessarily the one-by-one, but you we have for all FCMs, the aggregate annual cost is approximately $487 million, parentheses, you add two figures together, to fund the additional residual interest needed by FCMs due to 1.22 if residual interest were required at all times. And then you go on for several pages of analysis of saying, but that we delay that for 5 years, and then you have a figure later of a cost for the top 10 FCMs of about $78 million. But I don't know if that would help you try to answer Commissioner Malia's question.
We separately broke out the top 10 FCMs from the other FCMs because their costs are much, much different. The other thing is, the customers of the smaller FCMs are not going to be able to get their payments in as fast as the customers of the larger FCMs.
That's what we've heard, yeah. I agree with that. I got one more question. Back to Tom, I'm sorry. Can you explain the rules on the read-only access for the customer accounts? We've had some concerns about every bank providing an individual account number and password for each account and how we were going to secure them and how we would utilize them. There are a number of people that are saying that that's a cybersecurity hole waiting to happen. That's, you know, just turning over passwords and account numbers to put in a file drawer at the CFTC is somewhat perilous, especially since, you know, as you well know, it seems as though every time I come into the office, my password changes. So those constantly needed to be updated, I'm sure for very good reasons, of course. How are we going to secure those, maintain those, and not create a loophole for the banks that they have additional exposure that, you know, that there's without a doubt that we are not going to be the security hole in their cybersecurity net?
In the proposal, there was actually a bifurcated or two-step process that we had proposed. One was that any depository would provide us with any technology and connectivity capability, but not provide password or user IDs up front. In addition, you know, our need to access account balance through this direct online access is subject first to some other steps that we would try to use. One would be we're, you know, obtaining the information from the CME NFA through their collection of it directly now each day from depositories, and also our capability of, which is embedded in the segregation acknowledgement letters, to call and obtain confirmations. So if it, only in those situations where we couldn't or the data wasn't fresh enough for us from getting it from the NFA or CME or contacting a bank. We need it in another context. That's when we anticipated that we would use direct online access. We would have the connection established. It would be at that point that we would contact the depository institution to obtain a password and user ID. In discussions with the industry, they pointed out that there's some flaws in that analysis. While we thought we were making it easier so that we didn't have access to the passwords and IDs, it was suggested that the better approach would be to get full access up front and then let the a password and ID actually expire, because they already have the security systems in place to address a client who has misplaced or lost a password. So I think the idea is we would not necessarily have the password and IDs up front. We would wait until we did need it, and then they would be able to turn on that access, just like as we forget our passwords for our own private accounts.
You've worked with bank regulators and entities to say, you know, that have indicated that this is the appropriate way to do this?
We've dealt mostly with meetings with the FIA and with outside counsel for bank depositories. We have not dealt with bank regulators.
So could there be issues with bank regs prohibiting this type of access?
I don't think so, because it's basically a contractual agreement between the depository and the customer that they have, that they're allowing a third party to have access.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that I'd like to have considered. Can I ask consent that it be considered?
I think you do a motion and then I'll second it for you.
I ask for a motion that this be considered.
I'll second it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Amaya. I do think that you actually shared the document with the bank regulators, did you not, at some point in time, what we were doing? Certainly they had our proposal from, what's that?
Yes.
Kevin?
We have been working with, we got comment letters from the FIA and representatives of banks, and so we have had conversations with them about specific provisions and the mechanics of how this would work. We have not discussed it with bank regulators, and I would just echo what Tom said. It's actually a contractual matter, and the way the acknowledgement agreement is set up is that the FCM gives permission and authorizes designated persons, meaning the DSIO director and designees, to be provided access. So it is the customary practice in the banking industry that if it's my account, I can authorize certain transactions or arrangements, and one of them would be that other members, my family or third parties, are permitted to have access to my account. So it's really not a regulatory but a contractual matter.
Thank you. Commissioner Wiegand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in following up to the previous exchange, or actually the one before Phyllis's, Stephen, doesn't the cost-benefit analysis point out that it should not be necessarily assumed that pre-funding will be the solution in terms of meeting these new residual interest requirements?
Right. It doesn't have to come through pre-funding. It can come through the FCM getting the money sooner from customers. And it can also come from the FCM's capital, so it could require less pre-funding, but they might charge more in fees.
So is there any way to, does the cost-benefit analyze this, or is there any way to predict or try and?
Well, to really address it, you would need, you know, proprietary information about FCM customers and the different market segments and their sensitivity to the different things, pre-funding, paying sooner, and paying fees if they're borrowing from the FCM.
Steve, would it be accurate to say that we, at an aggregate level, did a fairly conservative approach of what the costs would be, and we've noted that there may be opportunities then for people to do things differently, and presumably if it were to cost less, they would do it differently. And so...
So our cost estimate, it was done at all times basis. We pointed out that there could be several mitigants to the at all times. First, they're not legally required to it. Also, they can go with lines of credits from a bank, so they don't have to keep all that on hand and so on. So the number was meant to be conservative to overestimate.
And then we basically also estimated these with the at the 6 p.m., at the time of settlement, but again, in each case, assuming that the FCM pre-funded it all themselves, and then there are alternative ways of getting there, including, you know, lines of credit and such. And so essentially, to the extent folks can do things more cheaply, one would expect that they would, and therefore the numbers we gave, I think, were intended to be a conservative high-end estimate of what those costs would be.
Yeah, well, I think as you pointed out, Steve, if it is, and you as well, Bob, if it is cheaper to find an alternative solution, one would imagine that's what most FCMs would do. I guess I alluded to that in my opening statement, that not only would I imagine that, I would expect that that would happen. That just seems like the most commercially prudent thing to do for most FCMs.
But we have to base our cost benefit on observation somewhere. So what would the line of credit cost? We just couldn't find, you know, any quotes or anything.
I just had a couple of other questions on the deadline, the residual interest deadline itself, and it reflects some on what was provided in the comment file and part of the preamble of the rule. But I think it's important to tease out here in this exchange, and that is, if there is a residual interest requirement that is, in fact, later in the day, to whom is it more likely that the costs and burdens will be shifted because of that practice?
So it's going to be the costs are going to be borne by those.
Well, and just to be more clear, the costs and burdens of margin shortfalls.
So as you go closer, it's going to go on the FCM, and it's going to go on customers that can't pay quickly because they're going to have to pre-fund more. But that it's for their trading too. So, or they might have to burden to have to pay higher fees if the FCM is going to pony up the money for them.
And Bob, I think I'll direct this to you. In your judgment, the later the time of the requirement, the residual interest requirement, falls in the course of a day, how does that impact the odds of compliance with the FCM segregation requirements and their other 4D requirements?
I'm not.
Well, I mean, the 4D says you can never use another customer's funds to top up the shortfall in another customer's fund. So the later in the day we require the residual interest requirement, how does that impact the fact, or how does that affect the odds that the FCM might be more likely to be out of compliance with 4D?
So the issue is that so long as we're having the 6 p.m. requirement, essentially what you're going to have is a gap there. So in other words, the FCM will be, for a time, using the funds of one customer to margin the positions of another. The longer that time, the more the exposure.
Sorry, not will be, maybe.
Yeah.
That's maybe. That's right.
Because there are some FCMs who might decide that compliance with the law is a good thing and stop whining and, you know, do what is expected to do.
But I think the issue is this, that there's that gap. What we're trying to do is at the end of the 5 years, then bring people back to where 4D requires them to be. And so avoiding that gap, because again, if, let's say, while the deadline is at 6 p.m., an FCM has made the payment up to the clearinghouse and they've used Peter's money to margin Paul's position, and at noon or at 3 p.m., sometime before the money comes in, the FCM goes bankrupt. So at that point, the gate comes down and the harm to Peter is realized. And so that's why it's important to get, you know, again, we're trying to do this in a measured way and give people time to get to do this most efficiently. But ultimately, that's why it's important to get to back to that initial time of settlement so that FCMs are not using one customer's money.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way I would state it a little bit differently is there is value in making it more difficult for an FCM to be out of compliance with 4D.
Absolutely,
indeed. Especially as you said in your remarks and others have said here on the dais, in the case of a bankruptcy.
Right,
and there's tremendous value there. So the issue then is it overly costly to get to where we land in this rule? And then secondly, how long will it take? And it seems that as I mentioned earlier, most of the space can get to where we land in 2019 in relatively short order, presumably even long before the beginning of 2019. But we just want to be sure, and so we're providing this long phase-in time.
Right. The key is the word use, right? So at the time that, if you're the FCM, at the time that you are using customers' money, you basically got to make sure that you're using the customers' money appropriately, and then you're not doing it inappropriately. So it is not appropriate, Section 40 says it's not appropriate to use one customer's money to margin another's position. So, which means that it is appropriate to use your money and not somebody else's. So the FCMs have a choice, right? Either collect margin deficits up front or use your own money.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Oh, absolutely. Commissioner May.
We haven't changed the pro rata bankruptcy treatment on customers. So if we have an FCM that is blown up due to a large customer failure, it can't meet coverage. And I know all of this is trying to get to a point where we'll have all the money, but listen, you know, things are going to happen. We can't predict it. To the extent we have an FCM failure, let's hypothetically, I'm sure we've solved it all here, but hypothetically, we may have one. In a bankruptcy treatment, everybody shares in that hole in a 4D account under pro rata distribution. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner May. I actually think there will be in the future futures commission merchants that fail because it's the nature of business and the nature of risk, and we have not in any way repealed the business cycle or that financial firms will make mistakes and risk will bring them down. What our regime is about protecting customers when that happens, because it will happen. Firms will fail. It's protecting them when that happens. I think, Melissa, we have an amendment and we have the base rule, and I turn it to you to tell us how we actually, you know, do the voting and so forth, but I turn it to our secretary.
First, we'll vote on the amendment.
What's that? Can you just say it more loudly?
First, the amendment comes before the base rule.
Yeah. Right. So,
if I could explain
my amendment, I appreciate everybody's indulgence here. My amendment would continue to make progress to accelerate the collection of margin and customers from 3 days after the settlement date to a one-day settlement date at 6 p.m. This would be phased in over 1 year after enactment, just like the draft rule. It would also require a study to determine the feasibility of changing the collection date and the cost associated with such a move, just like the draft rule. Most importantly, my amendment does not mandate that in 5 years' time, the customers will need to meet their margin obligations by the end of the settlement cycle, as proposed in the draft rule. This amendment simply lets a future commission make a determination about the best way to proceed after they collect all the evidence. The final rule, like many others, established a predetermined outcome and then conducts the feasibility study to determine whether the policy is feasible and cost-effective for all market participants. Other commission rules I can recall that similarly determined an outcome and then conducted a study include, as Bob mentioned earlier, the de minimis rule, and this study is phased to tie in with that, within the entity definition. The swap execution facility rule and the swap blocks rule are three good examples. Somehow, by imposing an outcome and then conducting the study process, this should make everyone feel better about the predetermined outcome. I, for one, don't feel better about it. I cannot support a rule that is a ready, fire, aim approach. Instead, I'm offering an amendment will do the following. First, it will not predetermine a policy outcome. The amendment requires a commission to study the feasibility and the costs and the technology solutions before it moves beyond a T1 at 6 p.m. settlement date. I'm cognizant of the fact that the approach of this rule is a major reinterpretation of decades of commission practice and shouldn't be taken lightly or without quantitative and technological analysis, as if and how market participants can move from T1 to the settlement cycle without onerous pre-funding arrangements. Second, my amendment will not bind a future commission. All of us at the table here today will have terms that expire by the time this rule contemplates any changes. There's no reason to believe that a future commission can't make an informed decision based on the facts and without a sort of Damocles hanging above it. Third, my amendment does not bias the study with an outcome that has already been predetermined. Under the circumstances provided in the final rule, commission staff can't possibly conduct an unbiased study because any analysis will be compared against a status quo of pre-funding solution tied to the end of the settlement cycle. It is ironic that we empower a future commission to make a fact-based determination, albeit predetermined, but refuse to take the same opportunities for ourselves. There's ample evidence that accelerating the payments can be done and provide better protections to customers. However, moving beyond the residual interest deadline of T plus 1, 6 p.m. to a 7 to 9 a.m. in the morning of the settlement cycle without resulting in pre-funding is far from certain. Small market participants believe they would be blocked from the market if they had to pre-fund their margin arrangements, and there is nothing in this document to suggest other possibilities. In fact, the cost-benefit analysis in this document even acknowledges that, which I read earlier, that smaller FCMs may have more difficulty than larger FCMs in absorbing the additional costs created by the requirements under the rules, particularly 1.22 parenthetical. It is also possible that some smaller FCMs may elect to stop operating as FCMs as a result of these costs, end quote. I would like to point out that last month the commission received a letter from the House and Senate authorizers on both sides of the aisle. They said, quote, the goal of increasing futures commission protection should be to strengthen the markets without harming the ability of American farmers and ranchers and end users to hedge their legitimate risks, end quote. This letter, which I have here, is urging the commission to make improvements without significant disruptions, and I don't believe this rule meets that test. So this rule, to be clear, is consistent in the time frames that we have set of 5 years of coming into compliance. It does not change that. In fact, the future commission could make a determination before that five-year time is up, and it could come to the exact same conclusion that is in this rule, or it can come with a different conclusion. I'm a big believer in technology, and I believe technology can solve many things, and I hope that's the case with this. And I hope that we can get to a cost-effective, improved solution to minimize any exposure whatsoever. But we're not there yet. And I just want to make sure we do this with our eyes wide open, we don't bias the study, and we let a future commission, which really will have the responsibility, either under the proposed rule or under my amendment, to make this decision going forward. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
I want to express my appreciation for Commissioner Malia's work on this rule, and as he's expressed that other than in this residual interest area, he's supportive of the many recommendations of the staff. And the enhancements that we're going to bring to people in the futures and swaps marketplace. And I take it even in residual interest provisions that you're supportive of the 6 p.m. cutoff, but it's what happens at the end of this study. I think that this balance is appropriate, the law, with allowing the commission to get more facts, a 30-month study, roundtable, and so forth, which, as you appropriately pointed out, was what we did with the Securities and Exchange Commission in seeking a compromise around what was the de minimis in becoming a swap dealer. A little shout out maybe to Commissioner Gallagher at the SEC, who came up with that idea in that circumstance. But I think that it's appropriate here, because it does allow 5 years for further study. And the provisions do allow, as Commissioner Wiegand said earlier, that if the commission then, after that study, wants to propose something else, they put out a notice of proposed rulemaking and simultaneously do an order at that point in time to change that five-year phase-in. So I don't see it binding futures commissions. I think where I might respectfully differ is I think that the law itself, the better read of the law, maybe the best read of the law, points to the settlement of this in the morning. And
future commissions will be benefited with a great deal more about cost and benefits, 30 months of data. They, too, can amend or change this. They could even work with Congress to change the law if that was what was appropriate, as you point to our authorizers. But I'm not going to be able to support your amendment, though I do appreciate all the hard work you've done, and we've gotten this close, Commissioner Amaya, to a full agreement on the document. But on this one, I'm on the other side of, I think, what the best read of the current statute is. I don't know if other commissioners want to say anything.
Mr. Radhakrishnan, so it's an interesting concept, Commissioner O'Malley, but I am curious about law, whether or not this would, the O'Malley Amendment would comport to the law. I mean, it's following up on what the chairman was saying, but if we did what Commissioner O'Malley is proposing, would that meet the test of the law?
In my view, any rule that goes past time of settlement is not comporting with the law. I'm sorry, I got to be honest with you guys, right? The rule we pass for cleared swaps comports with the law. What we're seeking to do here is to give more people more time to comply with the law. But if you're asking me what the law says, it's like, when you use the money, are you using somebody's money or not? And in our view, in DCR's view, what the commission did in clear swaps comports with the law.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
I'm no more illegal than
you're giving people more time, right? So you're giving people time to comply. I would urge the commission to not give people so much time that people forget about what the obligation under the law is.
No, ironically, my amendment could get faster to your outcome than their base text.
You know what my position is.
I don't disagree with what Commissioner O'Malley just said, but I do agree with Anand in the sense that I think the closer we get to that first settlement, the more likely we are to be in the closest fidelity of with the intent of the statute. And so I would imagine that there's probably full agreement on that. It's more of a question of how soon can we get there, and which is just a question of feasibility. And in light of that fact, and in light of the fact that we have a very fulsome comment file to this rule, the staff in front of us today has considered this carefully. I myself have looked into this. I mentioned the fact that I met in person with a number of producers who I think were most fearful of what was in the proposal. And I met with them, and I talked to other people who are involved in intermediating payment transfers to FCMs. And I don't think that what this what is reflected in the final today prejudges anything. We are making a judgment. We're making a judgment today based on what was in the comment file, based on other information that we've brought to bear on the work of the commission. And based on all of that, the commission is judging today that this can happen. It's the best reading of the law, but it probably just can't happen right now. And in the event that we're wrong about the amount of time it's going to take to ensure the maximum level of compliance, we have ability to move it further out in time. That's why I think this, on balance, what's contained in the final is preferable to what Commissioner Malia has in his amendment. Although I think what's in the amendment is perfectly reasonable too, another way of dealing with it. But I just think this is a better way. So I cannot support the amendment.
Secretary.
This is a vote on Commissioner O'Malley's amendment to the final rule enhancing protection afforded customers and customer funds held by futures commission merchants and derivatives clearing organizations. Commissioner Wiegand?
No.
Commissioner Wiegand, no. Commissioner O'Malley?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Malley, aye. Commissioner Chilton?
No.
Commissioner Chilton, no. Mr. Chairman?
No.
Mr. Chairman, no. Mr. Chairman, on this amendment, the ayes have one, the noes have three.
Then I hand it back to you. Okay.
We'll now be voting on the final rule on enhancing protections afforded customers and customer funds held by futures commission merchants and derivatives clearing organizations. Commissioner Wiegian.
Aye.
Commissioner Wiegian, aye. Commissioner O'Malley.
No.
Commissioner O'Malley, no. Commissioner Chilton.
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner Chilton, aye. Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, aye. Mr. Chairman, on this matter, the ayes have three, the noes have one.
With the vote being in the affirmative and the rule will then be sent to the Federal Register with any technical corrections because of that unanimous consent. I want to thank this team and not just those who are sitting at this table, but the dozens of others at this agency from the Division of Enforcement, the Office of General Counsel, of course, the Chief Economist, the two divisions that are represented here, Clearing and Risk and Swap Dealer and Intermediary Oversight, and probably so many others. This is the sixth of six rules that we have put in place over 2 years, from investment of customer funds to cleared swap, what was it called, legally segregated but operationally commingled, to gross margining at clearinghouses, to rules in designated contract markets about facilitating higher risk management. And of course, earlier today, by seriatim vote for segregation of customer funds for non-cleared swap accounts. So I want to thank you all for this. I do note that yesterday we noticed a meeting for next Tuesday the 5th, where we'll be taking up a number of matters, including looking at proposals for limits on positions, speculative position limits, aggregate across the futures and swaps marketplace. It'll be the third time that I get an opportunity to vote on such a rule. And I think it's probably the third proposal, maybe the fifth time to vote on something. So I look forward to coming back together next Tuesday on position limits and other matters as we put it on the agenda. With that, Commissioner O'Malley.
Commissioner Wiegian mentioned Volcker Rule a lot in the press about us doing a Volcker Rule before the end of the year. I have not seen a single piece of paper. Can you send us the document, please, immediately? I understand it's upwards of 1,000 pages, and if we're going to do this in mid-December, I better get reading now.
We're working staffs of five federal regulatory agencies plus the U.S. Department of Treasury, so six are trying to work through documents. I don't have a document to send at this point in time, but if I do in the next couple of days, I will share it. I will do my best. I am hopeful to try to schedule a public commission meeting for the second week of December or third week of December. I know we've all reserved a date on our calendars right now that Melissa has gotten from us, and we're working to try to get a document. I know that there's further what's called deputies meetings, but it's basically staff. Eric Remler, Paul Schlickstein, and others are sort of our point people working with the other federal regulators trying to move a document to a position to share it with commissioners.
Since staff has it, can they share the document with us?
I will share the document when I think it's appropriate, but at this point in time, it is still very much moving between the SEC, the FDIC, the Comptroller of the Currency, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury. But I'm working to try to get something in the next few days to week.
But if all those people are working on it and sharing it, why can't this commission have it?
The staff of all of these agencies is working through this document right now,
and I'm working to get that document to you as soon as we can, but it's not going to be today. I look to a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The meeting's adjourned.